Oyez, oyez, the Honorable, the Supreme Court of Texas. All persons having business before the Honorable, the Supreme Court of Texas, are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the state of Texas and this honorable court.
Thank you. Please be seated. Good morning. The court has two matters on its oral submission docket. And in the order of their appearance, they are docket number 050321, Texas A&M University System, Texas Engineering Experiment Station, and Dr. Mark McClellan versus Dr. Sifa Kotioglu from Brazos County and the 10th Court of Appeals District, and 050686, First Commerce Bank, formerly known as Brazosport Bank of Texas, versus Christine Palmer individually, and Christine Palmer and Frederick A. Palmer III, independent executors of the estate of Frederick A. Palmer Jr., from Brazoria County and the 13th Court of Appeals District. The court has allotted 20 minutes per side in each of these arguments, and we will take a brief recess between the two. These proceedings are being recorded, and a link to the arguments should be posted on the court's website by the end of the day today. The court is now ready to hear argument in 050321, Texas A&M University System and Others, versus Dr. Sifa Kotioglu.
May it please the court. Mr. Cruz will present argument for the petitioner. The petitioner has reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court. This case will help answer the question, how many interlocutory appeals does Texas procedure require to resolve the question of sovereign immunity from suit? The Court of Appeals answered three. This appeal for the university to get a remand, a later appeal for the university to perhaps get a rendition, and a distinct appeal for the university official sued in his official capacity. This court should reverse and hold that a single interlocutory appeal is capable of reaching those questions about sovereign immunity from suit.
But that would go against the statute's plain language. You want us to look at the purpose behind the plain language.
In regard to the question of 51.014A8 and whether the language pleaded the jurisdiction by a governmental unit encompasses Mr. McClellan's claim in his official capacity, we think that you don't need to go beyond the plain language because the introductory clause of 51.014A defines a person as the class of appellants. It doesn't restrict the appellants to being the governmental unit. So in the text of A8, when it says grants or denies a plea to the jurisdiction by a governmental unit, we think that's best read as reflecting an assertion of the entity's underlying sovereign immunity from suit. In Simons, this court acknowledged that plea to the jurisdiction is a term referring to the underlying immunity being asserted rather than to a particular form of pleading being used. And the court made the same pronouncement again in Thomas v. Long earlier this year. And this does best effectuate the legislature's intent, and it also reflects the common law understanding the legislature had in 1997 when it wrote this provision, that the sovereign immunity from suit is shared between the entity and the official sued in his official capacity, because when an official is sued in his official capacity, he is, in fact, a state. It is a different way of styling a pleading to get the same result. A suit against an official in their official capacity cannot achieve monetary damages or any judgment against that official as a human being. The only type of relief you can obtain in a suit, an official capacity suit, is relief that compels the governmental entity for which he works to do some sort of task. It's a legal task.
Why is it you can sue somebody individually in their official capacity? I mean, as we just went through, virtually every statute in Texas about a governmental entity says they can sue and be sued, which we said gives them capacity. Why can you sue somebody in their official capacity? Why shouldn't you just sue the city or A&M if it can sue and be sued?
The answer is developed differently in federal and state law, but I'll focus on the state law. And this court has used that distinction as a way to distinguish out suits that are improperly trying to direct state conduct or direct state officials who are acting within their discretion. So if you were to sue an official for having exercised their discretion in a certain way, you would have to frame that suit as them having exceeded the bounds of their discretion instead of acting within it. And the distinction in Texas law goes back at least to
Cobb v. Hill. But if it's in their official capacity, That'd be, I mean, then the agency's exceeded its discretion. I just wonder if it, where that came from.
Well, it came from the recognition that the state as sovereign is generally immune from suit.
And but but if you couldn't sue somebody in their, you know, putting aside 1983 and all these other things, if this is just really a suit against A&M, if you could only sue A&M or you could only sue the individual for, then the problem would go away. You could always appeal.
Well, I think it might generate other problems in the jurisprudence. The courts in Texas have developed this doctrine.
Well, I mean, this is a problem right here. If he had sued A&M, you, no question they can do the appeal, but because you do it against somebody in their individual capacity, then you arguably don't have an interlocutory appeal. And that doesn't make a lot of sense if, as you point out, they're identical suits.
Well, I guess let me answer the question this way. The problem that we're discussing was created by Section A8. When the legislature enacted this section, the understanding in Texas was that the entity has sovereign immunity from suit and that an official suit in their official capacity is, in essence, asserting the entity's underlying sovereign immunity from suit. There's no indication from this statute that the legislature meant to adopt some other type of waiver of immunity that would change that background common law. Nor should it have. The distinction is a useful one for the court to distinguish between appropriate actions at the margins of state authority, restrictions on the scope of discretion given to state officials, and a suit that would improperly try to control the exercise of that discretion.
So, and that would seem to make sense then that if the remedy is by summary judgment, the individual gets out on summary judgment because there may be some nuances between what the individual has done as an official versus some other unofficial act, and that can be thrashed out through evidentiary, a hearing, and a summary judgment.
I think that's exactly right. The usage of motion for summary judgment in A5 is a reflection of the fact that the official immunity defense, which is what the official would have when sued in their individual capacity as a defense against personal monetary liability, is very fact-intensive. It involves considerations such as whether the official was acting in good faith. And that is the type of issue typically that can be resolved by motion for summary judgment. So by distinguishing that, by setting aside motion for summary judgment as the proper vehicle for that type of issue, A5 does provide that vehicle for appeal. Whereas A8, discussing plea for the jurisdiction, is talking about the entity's underlying sovereign immunity from suit.
Well, that's I guess that's my point, is that A5 permits provides a remedy for the individual, official capacity or otherwise, whereas A8, as far as the governmental unit is concerned.
The Court of Appeals suggested that A5 would be a way for an official suit in his official capacity to bring an interlocutory appeal if he later filed a motion for summary judgment. But that wouldn't solve a couple of problems. First of all, it wouldn't allow the assertion of sovereign immunity from suit based on the pleadings. Which is a typical way that it comes up, especially in a case such as a breach of contract case like this. If the official suit in his official capacity had to wait for a summary judgment hearing, you wouldn't have that option. It also wouldn't permit a plaintiff to appeal from the denial of from the grant of such a motion for summary judgment. So it could, in a particularly complicated case, lead to more fragmentation. And in every case, it would lead to, in every case in which both an official and the entity is sued, it would lead to this duplicative appeal problem, in part because the legislature has proposed an automatic stay from the filing of a notice of appeal under either of these provisions. So whichever motion is resolved first is very likely to be the only issue before the appellate court until...
Well, the legislature obviously has gotten in the middle of this and decided different avenues of approach by the government and the officials. Why should we step in and say, in spite of the plain language of the statute, that, well, obviously they meant something else when they could have said it?
Well, the plain language of the statute, it uses the phrase governmental unit, but it also provides a place to look for the definition of that term. And it provides that, it says you look in Section 101.001 of the Tort Claims Act. And this makes sense based on what the legislature was concerned about. They wanted to ensure that, especially in tort cases, there was an avenue for this type of interlocutory appeal. And so they wanted to ensure that these were at least coextensive discussions of what a governmental unit was. we think, go against the legislature's intent to say that governmental unit means something narrower in this statute than it has been typically applied in the context of the Tort Claims Act, and it would prevent AA from fulfilling the legislature's purpose for that section.
So you think the Tort Claims Act definition includes employees?
In their official capacity, it does. And a number of courts of appeals have held that so long as it's in their official capacity. And to be clear, you cannot obtain individual liability against the person who holds the office through an official capacity suit. That would be an individual capacity suit, and we do not believe that would fall within AA. That would have to go through AFA. So it's not every tort case in which that official capacity issue comes up, but when it has, the courts of appeals have consistently said that governmental unit is meant to encompass those individuals so long as they're acting in their official capacity. Turning to the second question, which is whether the Court of Appeals should have rendered judgment or remanded for further pleading in this case, the general principle that's been announced is that rendition is proper if the plaintiff has already had a reasonable opportunity to amend. The dispute seems to be when that reasonable opportunity should come. And the Court of Appeals says it has to be after some adverse ruling, even if that's the first time an interlocutory appeal. But a much better rule seems to be that the plaintiff should have to respond to what the plea puts the plaintiff on notice of, so that when the trial court is deciding the plea to the jurisdiction, it can make a meaningful determination with everyone's arguments in front of it. And so if the issue goes up on interlocutory appeal, the Court of Appeals can make a meaningful determination without having the possibility of a plaintiff simply deciding to stand on his pleadings and wait until he's told that he needs to do a better job.
Well, if there was a special exception, they could do that.
They could, absolutely. A special exception wouldn't raise the court's jurisdiction in the same way a sovereign immunity from suit issue would. And it also
summary judgment that, no, they need to do something before summary judgment is granted, because you don't get a second chance after that.
That's absolutely
right. The reason you use a plea to jurisdiction is to keep them guessing.
I would disagree with that. The reason we use a plea to the jurisdiction is it's the...
You could have used a special exception. You could have used a summary judgment. But you chose to use a plea to the jurisdiction where they don't know which one it is. And now we're going to tell them from the Court of Appeals, you guessed wrong. You should have amended before the hearing.
No. The question is, when you have a plea to the jurisdiction is a distinct sort of category of thing. It may not have a broad presence in the rules or the statutes, but it has a presence
in
one.
Any presence.
It has presence in one particularly important and relevant provision, which is A8, that provides that a plea to the jurisdiction is appealable through interlocutory appeal. And and 51.014B provides for an automatic stay. And if you combine those two things, it means the only judicially manageable approach to this would be to ask the plaintiff to do what we ask litigants to do in lots of other situations in litigation, which is to put your cards on the table, to explain what you think your best case is for having a waiver of sovereign immunity, so that when the trial court makes its ruling, it can be meaningful. And if it goes up on appeal, the Court of Appeals can make a meaningful determination.
So you say a plea to jurisdiction should be governed by the same rules as a summary judgment?
Well,
because if it was a special exception, they don't have to put the cards on the table if they win. It's only if the trial judge says, you're right, that's not specific enough that they have to do it. They don't have to do that.
That is absolutely right. But in there are other situations in a litigation, for example, both sides objecting to the jury charge. Both sides have to put all their cards on the table. They don't know how the jury's going to come back.
What we're going to do, but your rule means we don't know, or either your rule is they always have to put, if you file a plea to the jurisdiction, they must put all their cards on the table.
If they have a reasonable opportunity to amend and they haven't done
Let's assume it's filed 10 days in advance, like all motions are in advance of the hearing. They have a reasonable opportunity in those 10 days to change. Your rule is pleas to the jurisdiction are just like summary judgments. Once the other side files it, if you make a change, if you want to change, you better do it before the hearing or you're out of luck, because you can't do it afterwards.
That's a feature it might share with summary judgments, but it shares that feature with many other aspects of litigation as well. And there are points in the litigation process where to ensure that things are moving along, you have to ask both sides to put their cards on the table. And because of the changes the legislature has made to interlocutory appeals, including especially perhaps the addition in 2003 of the automatic stay in 51.014B, the best approach is to require the plaintiff to put those cards on the table at the outset so that everyone involved in that process to make a meaningful determination.
How long is a reasonable opportunity to cure it?
Well, in this case, it was 4 months, and during...
Right, I know, but I mean, in terms of, like Justice Brister says, they filed a motion, how much time do they really have? Is 10 days enough?
It may depend on the use of discretion. Well, it may depend on the case, and it may be the situation where if a plaintiff feels that they need additional time for some reason to respond to a plea, that they could ask that of the trial court. But in this case, there was a four-month period during which the plaintiff made other types of responses. The plaintiff filed a motion for summary judgment, for example, on overlapping issues during that time. It's not as if that nothing was happening during the litigation. The plaintiff was actively involved on this issue, but had elected as a tactical matter to simply stand on his pleadings on the assumption that he could stand on them until he was told otherwise. And that is a rule that if the Court of Appeals' absolute rule that a plaintiff can always do this is adopted, that will lead to more delay in the process and would subvert the goal of the interlocutory appeal statute in the automatic stay to provide a quick, certain resolution of the question of sovereign immunity from suit.
Any further questions?
Mr. Cruz, real quick, as a factual matter, is there any allegation that Mr. McClellan was himself individually a party to the settlement agreement?
Not of which I'm aware at all. The settlement agreement doesn't have his signature on it, which I'm not sure answers the question fully, but the complaint that's been lodged in this case, only seeks execution of that contract, performance of that contract, and remedies that this court has held. Excuse my time is expiring. Briefly,
complete your answer, please.
Thank you, Your Honor. That this court has held that a classic case of a suit against an official being a suit against the sovereign is when it seeks to enforce performance of a contract, and that was the Herring case from 1923.
Thank you, Mr. Cruz. The court is ready to hear arguments from the respondent.
May it please the court. Mr. Rice will present argument for the respondent.
Chief Justice, many justices, counsel, ladies and gentlemen. I appreciate very much the opportunity to come before to stand before you today. I've been practicing for almost 20 years, and you always hope to be able to get here. I have to say this is my first time. So my only wish was that I would have been second on the docket so I could learn from someone else. So be it. I had a good teacher in my esteemed opponent. I'd like, if I may, to answer the last question.
I saw either a shake or a nod. I'm not sure which.
Okay.
Counsel table.
I'd like, if I may, to address the question you raised at the end of your question. Yes, Dr. McClellan was sued. But in his individual capacity, he was a party to this contract. He was a signatory. The dispute arose because he then refused to sign the contract that had been negotiated in his capacity individually as well as a representative of Texas A&M University. There were claims against Dr. McClellan individually that we would have asserted but for this settlement agreement, and those claims would have been waived by sovereign immunity.
What did he do wrong?
Well, there was a number of things that Dr. McClellan did wrong. First of all, as I believe you alluded to earlier, or maybe it was my opponent did, is that there were issues here about Dr. McClellan acting in bad faith. Dr. McClellan, my client, Dr. Cosolo, and it took me a year to figure out how to say that correctly, but it is Cosolo, had for a number of years, as we stated out in the statement of facts, established a business. Texas A&M University had for a number of years said, you can go do this on your own time. He invested money. He invested resources. When Dr. McClellan came in to replace him, he denied that request.
Because it's bad faith, is the answer.
He, in effect, was bad faith. The problem of bad faith, Judge, was because my client chose to appeal that decision, and he said, I'm firing you now because you chose to appeal it. He had a known right. He was acting in bad faith. But getting back to the case itself, this case, I believe, is about one thing on both points.
But you also sued him in his official capacity.
Yes, Your Honor, both officially and...
That is the same as the lawsuit against the university.
Well, I think that's what the cases would say, that it imposes liability. But I also believe if you're going to the second issue, which is the question under the tort law, Section 51, there's case law out there that says under subpart 5, it doesn't really matter whether someone's been sued in their individual capacity or official capacity.
It makes a big difference to me.
sue me in my individual capacity, I might actually have to pay.
But I understand that, Judge, but I'm talking for the purposes of whether or not you can come up on an interlocutory appeal.
Well, why would that make a difference?
Why would it make a difference?
Yes.
And why the distinction between both the summary judgment aspect and the pleading jurisdiction?
Why, if you're a governmental unit, can you go straight up? And if you're suing in a defendant in his or her official capacity, that's like a suit against the government. So why make this distinction?
Well, I believe, Judge, it goes back to a couple of issues. First of all, the first thing is I think on a plea to the jurisdiction, and this may have been the point that you were leading to earlier, it's merely a facial attack. You're looking at the pleadings, which are the gatekeeper to determine what evidence gets to the jury, and you're making a facial attack on those pleadings.
But it's a facial attack.
When you go to
attack,
a summary judgment.
It's a facial attack whether the university makes it or the official makes it. So what's the difference?
Because under the summary judgment standard, if we're suing him in his individual capacity, Your Honor, we then get to his attack is on the underlying facts, much like in Miranda.
But the question was, why is it different whether it's the office or the office holder, as long as they're both official? Why distinguish there?
Again, Judge, I think it goes back to the issue of what are you trying to impose. We were trying to impose personal liability on Dr. McClellan.
Not when you sued him in his official capacity.
But we sued him as a signatory to that contract. We were asking him to perform.
I'm assuming, I haven't looked back at the pleadings, you sued him in his individual capacity.
Yes, sir.
Put that away. If you sued him in his official capacity, though, why is that?
Well, I'll acknowledge that the case law says that an official capacity suit is, in effect, a suit that imposes liability on the sovereign.
And so the question back again was, so why should the appeal be treated differently?
Because I think that's what the legislature said. And I think it goes back to the point that you were raising earlier when you started out. This court is not to come in and determine what the legislature said.
Well,
drew a distinction.
Could it possibly be that in order to discern the difference between official and individual capacity, you've got to get into a bad faith inquiry, which is fact intensive and more appropriate for summary judgment?
I believe that's correct. I agree with you, Justice O'Neill. And I think that in effect was in Miranda, if you looked at the two vehicles they were comparing, which, by the way, I think Miranda, which was decided a month before Sykes, reaffirmed the Brown standard on the amendment issue. But if you look at Miranda, Miranda was comparing a facial attack versus a substantive attack. That in that particular case, they chose to use the substantive issues, which got into the underlying issues, which were factual questions. It had to
and
be
in Miranda, we said the process in considering evidence and the plea to the jurisdiction is summary judgment-like.
We said it was summary judgment-like. That's correct.
So it's not Miranda, Sykes, Long, Simon, none of which the Court of Appeals cites in discussing what type of vehicle comes under these particular interlocutory appeal provisions. We said that it is the substance of the vehicle, not the title of the vehicle, that determines this whether you're raising immunity.
Well,
if you notice, in Chapter 51, the legislature used our terms, summary judgment. That's our term. We defined it. Plea to the jurisdiction. That's our term. We defined it. And we've said that in a jurisdictional attack, it's the substance of the matter. So why shouldn't we presume that the legislature is basing their consideration here not on the technical title of the vehicle or the motion, but on what we've said, which is you focus on the substance of the motion?
I think you posed a good question, Justice Wainwright, but I'd go back to the point that Justice Brisker raised before, and that is they had one of three vehicles. They chose the facial attack. It wasn't a substantive. In this particular case, it was a plea to the jurisdiction on the face of the pleadings. That is not like a summary judgment.
I don't understand when you say that Miranda was a facial attack.
No, I said Miranda was a substantive attack. They did address the Brown standard if there was a facial attack for the purposes of amendment.
How do you distinguish facial attack from substantive attack?
Well, I think
Miranda was certainly substantive. This is certainly a substantive matter, isn't it? Are you distinguishing between pleadings and facts?
Yes, Your Honor.
I see.
I think basically under the standard, under the pleaded jurisdiction standard, and if you look at the cases that even, for example, that get into the second issue that we're going to raise, which is amendment, they say the first inquiry is solely the pleadings. If you attack and you bring evidence on, in the form of affidavits or other things, then in effect you've made a substantive attack. In this particular case, they solely chose to attack the pleadings themselves. And they said the pleadings, which are the gatekeeper to determine what evidence goes to trial, are inadequate. In every instance, the courts have consistently said that we're going to allow those vehicles to be analyzed, and then if they're found deficient, give an opportunity to amend. But they attack only the face. They didn't put on evidence and say, well, McClellan did this or he didn't do this. It said, you can't sue him because of this, because of the case law on a legal fact, a legal standpoint as opposed to a factual discussion that Justice O'Neill addressed. And I think that's how you give, I think personally that's how you give meaning to all of the terms. I think you, I would agree to the extent that it says that a plea to the jurisdiction can be used as a vehicle for a substantive attack, and therefore if it would be different, but they didn't do it.
You're confusing when you say substantive versus facial. A plea to the jurisdiction that challenges the whether you sufficiently pled a cause of action is a substantive challenge. What you mean is facial on the pleadings versus factual, right?
That's what I mean.
Okay, because both can be substantive.
Well,
going to the merits.
They had a choice to attack the underlying facts here. They chose not to.
Let me ask you this. If the facial attack would also get rid of the official capacity claim, then why shouldn't an official asserting immunity be able to bring that up if it's a facial challenge? Did that make any sense?
I understand what you mean, Justice.
I understand.
I'm not sure I want to answer the question.
But I understand the factual distinction that might apply if you're looking at whether there was good faith or not, and that's more conducive to a summary judgment motion. But if it's a facial attack, that would vitiate the official's
A, does it
well.
Fall within the one of the exceptions under the tort claim claim? Have you pled facts, regardless of whether they're true or not, that get you through the waiver under Tort Claims Act?
Right.
If you're purely showing the suing the sovereign, I would agree with you.
No, but I mean, why shouldn't
and
that
And you're
apply?
Saying if you make a mistake and you name the individual, but in effect you met the sovereign, it's the same thing?
Well, what I'm saying is that there's no – let's presume we're going under the prong of you from the face of the pleadings, you can tell that no claim can be asserted here. Why shouldn't then the official be able to assert immunity interlocutorily if you don't have to look at the underlying facts to make that distinction?
Well, I think I would agree if there were not an individual capacity suit being brought, but that was not the case in this instance.
But that would still leave open the individual capacity claim. It would just bring up the official immunity and knock that out.
Where all you're attempting to do is impose liability on the sovereign. And I think that's what you're asking. If I'm wrong, let me know. But if all your intent is to impose liability on the sovereign, then I think you go under A. But in this case, we were trying to impose liability on McClellan. And I think the legislature was clear. I think the other reason I think you have to look at, as we raised in our brief, is the legislature specifically said, look to 101 to determine what a governmental unit is. And they have to be presumed to have known what they meant. They could have brought that out of under 5, but they didn't do it under 5.
Let me see if I understand what you just said. Are you saying that if you sue Dr. McClellan and the university, but Dr. McClellan only in an official capacity, are you saying that you're not trying to impose individual liability at all? On that basis, you would say that both the Dr. McClellan and the university would have an interlocutory appeal?
Well, I'm not sure I want to go that far. the question gets back to what are you trying to do? We're looking at a vacuum, but I think that if you're going to look at a pleading and someone has named Dr. McClellan, he put his name down for a reason. I think you then have to get into factual issues. If Dr. McClellan didn't think there was a basis for the waiver, he should put on facts that said, I didn't act in bad faith. So I know I'm probably confusing you, but the point is, I think you have to look at the pleadings. The pleading said Dr. McClellan. If Dr. McClellan wanted to challenge whether this was about him personally or whether it was really about the sovereign, and you just happened to put my name down there, then he should have put on facts to that point.
So,
and I think that's what the legislature was saying.
Okay, I guess I'm not following that. But
and I'm probably not doing a very good job of explaining.
So the you wouldn't have any objection then if at the time of the interlocutory appeal, any official claims, any claims that were attempting to bind the sovereign, which would include the official capacity claims of Dr. McClellan, would go up on the interlocutory
appeal? I would, because I think the question has to be determined by the weight of the facts. I think you have to look at I think it has to be a factual attack, whether you call it substantive or looking at a summary judgment standard. It has to be by summary judgment, because you have to look at the facts to make the determination.
What if the vehicle is called a motion to dismiss, but in the discussion that the parties argue about lack of evidence or insufficient evidence, and there's affidavits, and the whole legal debate is about sovereign immunity and jurisdiction? What does that fit under, A8 or A5?
I think that's confusing. I think that the safeguard of the summary judgment is you get the 21 days notice. You have a right to amend 7 days before the date of the hearing, and if you don't, you've lost your chance. Motion to dismiss, what does it mean? 3 days before, 21 days, what do I have to do?
Well, I understand there may be procedural issues there, but as to 51.014, is it a motion for summary judgment under A5 or a plea to the jurisdiction under A8? Or does it matter?
Well,
as long as we know the substance of it.
I think the problem has arisen because people have not followed the standards that are set out. A motion for summary judgment is a definite vehicle. If you're going to use it, you need to use it.
And
you
in Miranda,
abide by those rules.
And in Miranda, we set a plea to the jurisdiction where facts are presented, evidence is submitted,
it
follows a summary judgment-like
life.
Procedure.
But it didn't. But still, if you looked at, I believe it was Justice Jefferson's dissent, it got into the issue about whether or not the 21 days was there, or whether or not you had time to amend, if you should have, so forth and so on.
Those were good points. The majority opinion said that a plea to the jurisdiction where evidence is considered follows a summary judgment-like process.
If I may, fortunately, though, I think that opinion on both sides was consistent on the second issue, which is on Brown. I think that if you look substantively at what the majority said in that opinion, it said that if there is what I call described as a facial attack on the pleadings, then you use the standard set out in Brown. If, however, you're looking at the substance, if you're going to attack the underlying facts and you're going to offer facts, then it's a different standard.
So
in that particular case, Miranda reaffirmed Brown, and Miranda was only 1 month before Sykes.
Okay. So
and I believe that's this court's pronouncement.
Is it fair to say that whether the motion is called a plea to the jurisdiction or a motion for summary judgment determines the appeal rights entirely, the title of the document?
I believe that if we begin to stray too far afield of this court's guiding principles on how you construe statutes, that's when we create these problems. I think the legislature intended summary judgment to mean summary judgment.
If you could amend, what are you going to say?
Well, first of all, I believe that we're going to, and we have, by the way, already amended. It was filed in response to the Court of Appeals opinion on the reverse and remand. We have sued, obviously under Section 1983, we've sued this for prospective. I mean, we've sued for prospective relief, not retroactive relief. We said we would have sued also for injunctive relief to have Dr. Pistola reinstated into his position. We would have been able to get the not prospective but retroactive pay, the pay he lost, to have that reinstated.
So you've asked for different relief.
Well, what we've said is the case is still a breach of contract case. We say we had an agreement. We settled an underlying dispute. But the underlying dispute under the Lawson standard, we have to look at what the claims were underlying, and we have to say, was there a waiver? Well, if we had never settled our lawsuit, we would have been able to sue for injunctive relief to have him reinstated. We would have been able to sue to have his back pay. We would have also been able to sue against Dr. McClellan individually under the bad faith standards. And we would have sued Dr. McClellan in his official capacity, which would have ended up imposing liability on the sovereign also. There were also a number of other things. We believe there's some takings cases, taking cause cases that we could have asserted that we've alleged that would have been asserted where there would have been a waiver. All of those things have been pled only to get us through Lawson that says if the settlement settles a case where the underlying claims have been, where sovereign immunity is waived, you get there. And we think these facts get us there. And if I may, just to go to the second issue, and I believe the question, and it may have been Justice Green that brought it up, is, well, how long is enough? This court has laid down a standard. It's been followed for quite a few years. It was affirmed in Sykes. It was reaffirmed in Miranda. And it was recognized in Brown. Brown is a different case, in effect. And what that court said is, as Justice Jefferson said in his dissent in Miranda, is you come to the point of the decision, which is by the judge, and if the judge says denied, then you do one thing. You don't have to amend. If he says granted, then he says, before I grant it, I'm going to look at the pleadings and I'm going to decide, are they incurably defective? In this case, the Court of Appeals determined correctly that they were not incurably defective. And they said, before we dismiss your case, before we levy this draconian measure, the death penalty, we're going to give you a right to amend. And I would take issue with the point that my esteemed co-counsel raised earlier, which he said this is consistent with other things in litigation. This is inconsistent with how litigation is handled. The pleadings are the driving force. We learned in law school that you put a pleading down on paper, and that determines what evidence gets into trial. When you come to a summary judgment hearing, it's like a mini trial. You better amend your pleadings, or when you get to the summary judgment hearing, you can't put on the evidence. That's why it makes a difference there. But if you look throughout our cases, if you look at the rules of procedure, it is always given liberal leeway to amend. That's why this court has historically adopted a rule that says once we determine there is no waiver of sovereign immunity, we then look to the pleadings, and it is totally an issue of whether the pleadings themselves are sufficient.
Counsel, if that's a rule, why is it not simply an advisory opinion from the court telling you you don't get there on this, try again. You don't get there next time. You don't get there on that. Try again. I think that
applies. The same thing would apply for special exceptions. It would apply for everything.
Except in a special exception, you're telling the court, I don't understand what they're wanting. I don't understand what they're claiming against me.
Or you can
make
argue
them
my
specify.
Way.
So why didn't you do that? Why can't you do that in one of these cases?
If
they file a plea to the jurisdiction, say, whoa, judge, you're going to hear that after a while. I don't understand what they're saying. Make them tell me what they're saying.
I think the flip side is true. I think that to argue otherwise would say that they, in effect, the state is the one that gets to make the call every time. And then you get into a problem where we have all of these abusive discretion cases that go up on appeal and say, well, he only gave me 4 weeks. Well, he only gave me 5 weeks.
How much time did you need?
Judge, in this particular case, the case law out of this court said you could go to the hearing and then decide. And that's what we relied on, certainty. We relied on what this court had said over and over again and what every other case has said. And by the way, O'Neill, I believe, is consistent with that. If you look at O'Neill, which is what an unreported opinion, the only opinion that even goes out there to talk about time, in that opinion, not in the footnote, but in the case itself, it said they had waived their right because they had not requested a right to appeal, number one, and number two, the pleadings were incurably defective. They followed your rule in that case because that's what they relied on. And then in a footnote, they make some comment about the lawyer should have done it earlier. But this court has always said, and as a litigant, Dr. Casolo has a right to go into the court and say, I believe I'm right, and if I'm wrong, give me one chance to fix my problem. If I don't, kick me out of there.
Further questions? Thank you, Mr. Wright.
May it please the court. I have three very brief points I'd like to make in the rebuttal. The first is a response to Justice O'Neill's question about why a motion for summary judgment isn't a better vehicle to resolve the distinction between official and individual capacity suits. And the answer is that to make that distinction for our purposes, you look at the relief being sought. If the relief is to control state action or impose liability on the state, it's an official capacity suit. If the relief is personal liability against Dr. McClellan, it would be an individual capacity suit. And the question of good faith, the fact-intensive question, doesn't come up at that threshold point. It comes up later in evaluating the merits of the affirmative defense of official immunity. So that's the reason why that would be why that's not a useful way to draw that distinction for our purposes. The second point relates to the question of whether the complaint that was actually filed in this case, pages 1 to 15 of the clerk's record, states a claim against Dr. McClellan in his official or individual capacity. And the complaint doesn't use either of those magic words, but if you look at the function of what it's doing, it's seeking to impose contract liability on the state. It's not alleging that Dr. McClellan did anything that was outside of his, that would have created individual liability, and it's only seeking to enforce the contract against the state. And, you know, although it doesn't use the magic word official or individual capacity, courts have looked before to see from the substance of what's being pled what the party is really seeking to do. And the third point I'd like to respond to is the idea that the complaint has since been amended by a document that was filed after the Court of Appeals decision in this case. It's somewhat difficult to respond in the sense that it's not before this court in this appeal, but there is an automatic stay imposed by 51.014b. The notice of appeal in this case was filed on October 18, 2003. The effective date of the 51.014b was for any notice of appeal filed after September 1, 2003, and the statute says that it stays all proceedings in the trial court. And the purpose was to allow the Court of Appeals to make a meaningful determination with everything else frozen, and it would subvert that purpose if a party could later come back and amend to try to change the ground rules during the course of the appeal. But in response to the substance of that, the first is that this attempt to go back and add lots of claims that were not actually what the part, well, that in a Lawson-type context, that
they weren't settled, is your point. They weren't settled.
That's exactly right. That these were not the claims that the parties were discussing at the time. That the only claim that was being discussed, the only claim in the correspondence that's in the record here, is a notion of due process that was later fleshed out to a due process claim for prospective relief. And that I would point out to the court that that claim, a due process claim for prospective relief, was also in play in Lawson. That in Lawson, two different claims that survived the plea of the jurisdiction, the Whistleblower Act and the due process claim for merely prospective relief. And the plurality noted that the only claim for damages that survived was the Whistleblower Act claim. And the court's reasoning placed great reliance on the fact that it was a legislative waiver of immunity from suit. If it were true that just merely having a due process claim for prospective relief would entitle you to a waiver, all of that would have been unnecessary. And we think the distinction drawn between those two things makes very good sense because of the different kinds of liability being imposed on the state. When the legislature creates liability for something like the Whistleblower Act, it's making a balancing determination of what types of remedies might be available and a decision to impose the state the financial liability. That's not true at all for prospective relief, especially in a due process claim, where the outside, the most the plaintiff would be entitled to, is the process that they were due. And to allow that, if that becomes the loophole through which this settlement can fit, then in essence the parties can impose far greater liability on the state than the legislature has ever considered in this context, which would be an undue expansion of Lawson.
Any questions? Thank you, Counselor. The cause is submitted, and the court will now take a brief recess.